if they could suggest a way forward. As he'd put it to Elizabeth in an email a few months earlier, he was convinced her invention would be a game-changer for his men. Gutierrez and Shoemaker proposed a solution, a limited objective experiment, using leftover de-identified blood samples from soldiers. It would obviate the need to obtain informed consent, and it was the only type of study that could be put together as quickly as Mattis seemed to want to proceed. They agreed to pursue that course of action. 15 minutes after they'd walked in, Shoemaker and Gutierrez shook Mattis's hand and walked out. Shoemaker was immensely relieved. All in all, Mattis had been gruff but reasonable, and a workable compromise had been reached. The limited experiment agreed upon fell short of the more ambitious live field trial Mattis had had in mind. Theranos's blood tests would not be used to inform the treatment of wounded soldiers. They would only be performed on leftover samples after the fact to see if their results matched the Army's regular testing methods. But it was something. Earlier in his career, Shoemaker had spent 5 years overseeing the development of diagnostic tests for biological threat agents, and he would have given his left arm to get access to anonymized samples from service members in theater. The data generated from such testing could be very useful in supporting applications to the FDA. Yet, over the ensuing months, Theranos inexplicably failed to take advantage of the opportunity it was given. When General Mattis retired from the military in March 2013, the study using leftover de-identified samples hadn't begun. When Colonel Edgar took on a new assignment as commander of the Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases a few months later, it still hadn't started. Theranos just couldn't seem to get its act together. In July 2013, Lieutenant Colonel Shoemaker retired from the Army. At his farewell ceremony, his Fort Detrick colleagues presented him with a Certificate of Survival for having the courage to stand up to Mattis in person and emerging from the encounter alive. They also gave him a T-shirt with the question, "What do you do after surviving a briefing with a 4-star?" written on the front. The answer could be found on the back. Retire and sail off into the sunset. Chapter 11. Lighting a Fuse. The doorbell at 1238 Coldwater Canyon Drive in Beverly Hills rang at 10:15 a.m. on Saturday, October 29, 2011. The gated one-story Italian villa, shrouded by palm trees, belonged to Richard and Lorraine Fuse. The couple had purchased it 2 years earlier to live closer to their children, who had both moved from Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles after graduating from Georgetown University. When Richard Fuse opened the door, a process server tried to hand him a stack of legal papers. "I'm here to serve a lawsuit on Fuse Technologies," the man said. Fuse told him he couldn't accept service because the company, though it bore his name, was no longer his. He had sold it more than a decade earlier. It was now part of Canadian drug maker Valiant Pharmaceuticals, he explained. The man placed a call and repeated what Fuse had said. The response, conveyed by someone shouting on the other end of the line, was that he was at the right address and to just serve the papers. But Fuse continued to refuse to take them. Losing his patience, the process server threw them at his feet and left. Fuse took out his cell phone and snapped a photo of the pile scattered across the sidewalk. He knew very well what this was about. As a co-defendant in the lawsuit, he'd been personally served with a similar set of papers 2 days earlier. After mulling things over for a minute, he crouched down and picked up the mess. He decided he didn't want the neighbors to see it. The lawsuit had been filed by Theranos in federal court in San Francisco. It alleged that he had conspired with Joe and John Fuse, his sons from his first marriage, to steal confidential patent information from the company and used it to file his own rival patent. The theft, the suit alleged, had been carried out by John on behalf of his father while he was employed at Theranos's former patent counsel, McDermott, Will, and Emery. The top of the complaint's first page showed that Theranos had hired the famous lawyer David Boyce to represent it. However, as renowned as Boyce was, someone at his firm had fumbled their research and named the wrong Fuse company. It was Fuse Pharma, Richard and Joe's new firm, not Fuse Technologies, that the patent in question had been assigned to. Fuse had refused service because he wanted to make Boyce sweat his mistake. Fuse and his sons were angered by the suit, but they weren't overly worried about it at first. They were confident in the knowledge that its allegations were false. The first and only time Fuse had brought up Elizabeth Holmes's startup with John was in an email he had sent his son in July 2006 with a link to a Theranos patent application he'd spotted in the patent office's public database. The email, which was sent more than 2 months after Fuse filed his own provisional patent, asked if John knew who at McDermott had worked on the Theranos application. John replied that McDermott was a large firm and that he had no idea. The exchange had scarcely registered with John. More than 5 years later, he had no memory of it. As far as he was concerned, this lawsuit was the first time he'd seen or heard the word Theranos. John had no reason to wish Elizabeth or her family ill. On the contrary, when he was in his early 20s, Chris Holmes had written him a letter of recommendation that helped him gain admission to Catholic University's law school. Later, John's first wife had gotten to know Noelle Holmes through Lorraine Fuse and become friendly with her. Noelle had even dropped by their house when John's first son was born to bring the baby a gift. Moreover, Richard and John Fuse weren't close. John thought his father was an overbearing megalomaniac and tried to keep their interactions to a bare minimum. In 2004, he'd even dropped him as a McDermott client because he was being difficult and slow to pay his bills. The notion that John had willingly jeopardized his legal career to steal information for his father betrayed a fundamental misunderstanding of their frosty relationship. But Elizabeth was understandably furious at Richard Fuse. The patent application he had filed in April 2006 had matured into U.S. patent 7,824,612 in November 2010, and now stood in the way of her vision of putting the Theranos device in people's homes. If that vision was someday realized, she would have to license the barcode mechanism Fuse had thought up to alert doctors to patients' abnormal blood test results. Fuse had rubbed that fact in her face the day his patent was issued by sending a Fuse Pharma press release to info@theranos.com, the email address the company provided on its website for general queries. Rather than give in to what she saw as blackmail, Elizabeth had decided to steamroll her old neighbor by hiring one of the country's best and most feared attorneys to go after him. David Boyce's legend preceded him. He had risen to national prominence in the 1990s when the Justice Department hired him to handle its antitrust suit against Microsoft. On his way to a resounding courtroom victory, Boyce had grilled Bill Gates for 20 hours in a videotaped deposition that proved devastating to the software giant's defense. He had gone on to represent Al Gore before the Supreme Court during the contested 2000 presidential election, cementing his status as a legal celebrity. More recently, he'd successfully led the charge to overturn Proposition 8, California's ban on gay marriage. Boyce was a master litigator who could be ruthless when he felt the situation required it. In one case that illustrated his no-holds-barred ethos, he had escalated a business dispute between a client and the owner of a small Palm Beach lawn care company into a federal racketeering lawsuit, in which he'd accused the man and three of his gardeners of conspiracy, fraud, extortion, and, last but not least, violating antitrust law. After a judge in Miami dismissed the suit, Boyce appealed the verdict to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit in Atlanta. Only after that appeal failed did he drop the case. Boyce's law firm, Boyce, Schiller, and Flexner, had gained a reputation for aggressive tactics. It didn't take the Fuses long to find out why. In the weeks before Theranos sued, all three had picked up clues that they were under surveillance. Richard Fuse noticed a car tailing him when he drove to Van Nuys Airport to board a flight to Las Vegas. Joe, who lived in Miami, was warned by his neighbor, a retired cop who acted like his block's self-appointed captain, that someone was watching his house. John and his wife spotted a man taking pictures of their home in Georgetown. The Fuses now felt sure those had been private investigators hired by Boyce. The surveillance continued after the suit was filed and unnerved Fuse's wife, Lorraine. Cars were frequently parked across the street from their Beverly Hills house, a driver sitting idle inside. One day, Lorraine noticed that the person behind the wheel was a blonde woman and became convinced that it was her old friend, Noelle Holmes. Fuse thought that was unlikely, but grabbed his camera and a telephoto lens and took a picture of the car, a gray Toyota Camry, from inside the house. He then walked outside to confront the driver. As he approached the car, it sped off. When he later took a closer look at the photo, he couldn't make out the woman's face well enough to rule Noelle out. That upset Lorraine even more. She felt sure the Holmeses were out to bankrupt them and take possession of their house. She became nearly hysterical. Boyce's use of private investigators wasn't just an intimidation tactic. It was the product of a singular paranoia that shaped Elizabeth and Sonny's view of the world. That paranoia centered on the belief that the lab industry's two dominant players, Quest Diagnostics and Laboratory Corporation of America, would stop at nothing to undermine Theranos and its technology. When Boyce had first been approached about representing Theranos by Larry Ellison and another investor, it was that overarching concern that had been communicated to him. In other words, Boyce's assignment wasn't just to sue Fuse, it was to investigate whether he was in league with Quest and LabCorp. The reality was that Theranos was on neither company's radar at that stage, and that, as colorful and filled with intrigue as Fuse's life had been, he had no connection to them whatsoever. 2 months after Theranos filed its lawsuit, Kecker and Van Nest, the law firm John Fuse hired to defend him, sent Boyce several documents that went a long way toward disproving Theranos' accusations. One of them was a declaration by Brian McCauley, McDermott's records manager, stating that a thorough search of the firm's records management and email systems had shown that neither John nor his secretary had ever accessed any Theranos files. Attached to the declaration were exhibits showing all the steps McCauley had taken to arrive at his conclusion. But in a response 5 days later, Boyce dismissed the documents as self-serving and not very persuasive. Richard Fuse tried to appeal directly to the Theranos board by sending its members several letters. In one of them, he included a photo of Elizabeth as a child to make the point that the families had once been on friendly terms and had known each other a long time. With another, he enclosed a binder filled with copies of all the emails he and his patent attorney had exchanged leading up to his April 2006 patent application to show that the patent stemmed from his own work. He also offered to meet with the board members. The only response he got was from Boyce, who wrote back that Theranos was puzzled as to why he thought the emails proved anything. Although he didn't have a shred of evidence to prove that John Fuse had done what Theranos alleged, there were some things in John's past that Boyce planned to use to sow doubts in the minds of a judge or jury. In 1992, when John was fresh out of law school, he had acted as a courier between his father and a college friend who worked at the law firm Skadden, Arps, Slate, Meager, and Flom. The college friend had given John a stack of Skadden billing documents to pass on to his dad. At the time, Richard Fuse was in a legal battle with a Skadden client, the heavy equipment maker Terex Corporation, which had sued him for libel for telling a congressional committee that it sold Scud missile launchers to Iraq. Even though the incident was 20 years old and the libel suit had been settled without any court finding that John had done anything wrong, Boyce intended to use it to suggest he had a history of funneling stolen information to his father. There was something else Boyce planned to exploit that was both more recent and potentially more damaging. McDermott had forced John to resign in 2009 after he clashed with the firm's brass in an unrelated matter. The cause of the dispute had been John's insistence that the firm withdraw its reliance on a forged document in a case before the International Trade Commission, in which McDermott was representing a Chinese state-owned company against the U.S. government's Office of Unfair Import Investigations. McDermott's leadership had agreed to withdraw the document, but the move had severely weakened the Chinese client's defense and angered the firm's senior partners. The firm had subsequently asked John to leave, citing a list of other incidents that it said showed a pattern of behavior unbecoming of a partner. One of the reasons cited was a complaint a client had made about John. At the time, the firm had refused to tell John who the client was or what the complaint was about, but he now figured it must have been Elizabeth's September 2008 complaint to Chuck Work about his father's patent. Boyce's strategy of painting John Fuse in a bad light was dealt a setback in June 2012 when the judge overseeing the case dismissed all the claims against John on the grounds that California's one-year statute of limitations for legal malpractice had expired. Boyce turned around and sued McDermott in state court in Washington, D.C., but that suit was soon dismissed when the court ruled that Theranos' allegations against John and the firm were completely speculative. Simply because attorneys within the firm had access to the Theranos documents does not mean the firm did not maintain confidentiality, the judge wrote. Yet Boyce was still in business. While dismissing the claims against John, the judge in the California case had allowed many of the claims against Richard and Joe Fuse to stand, and the case to proceed to trial. John might no longer be a defendant, but Boyce could still use the same narrative of collusion between father and son to argue his case against Richard and Joe. As the litigation dragged on into the fall, John's initial annoyance with the case morphed into full-blown fury at Elizabeth. After leaving McDermott, he had founded his own practice, and the Theranos case and its allegations had cost him several clients. Opposing counsel had also brought them up to tar him in two of his cases. By the time Boyce Schiller attorneys deposed John in the spring of 2013, his anger was made rawer by another source of stress. His wife, Amanda, had been diagnosed with a vasa previa, a complication of pregnancy in which the fetus's blood vessels are exposed and at risk of rupture. She and John were in anxious limbo until the baby reached 34 weeks and doctors could deliver her and place her in the neonatal intensive care unit. Even in the best of times, John had a short fuse. Growing up, he often got into fights with other boys. Under the questioning of one of Boyce's partners that day, he became combative and ornery, using foul language and letting his temper flare. At the end of the 6.5-hour deposition, he made a threat that played right into Boyce's hands. Asked by one of his father's lawyers whether the case had caused him reputational harm, and if so, whether that had affected his demeanor during the deposition, he responded, "Absolutely, I am more than pissed off at these people. I intend to seek my revenge and sue the fuck out of them when this is over, and you can guarantee I will not let Elizabeth Holmes have another fucking company as long as she lives. I will use my ability to file patents and fuck with her until she dies, absolutely." While John Fuse's anger was boiling over, his father and brother were becoming concerned with how expensive the litigation was getting. They had hired the Los Angeles law firm Kendall, Brill, and Klieger to represent them at a cost of about $150,000 a month. Laura Brill, the partner who was handling their case, wanted to file an anti-slap motion to try to get the Theranos suit thrown out as frivolous, which would have cost an additional $500,000 with little assurance that it would succeed. They decided to switch to a smaller and less expensive Northern California firm called Bainey & Ishimoto and hired the George Washington University Law School professor Stephen Salzberg, who had done legal work for Fuse in the past, to oversee its work. On the other side, they knew they were up against one of the most expensive lawyers in the world. Boyce charged clients nearly $1,000 an hour and was reputed to earn more than $10 million a year. What they didn't know, however, was that in this instance, he had accepted stock in lieu of his regular fees. Elizabeth had granted his firm 300,000 Theranos shares at a price of $15 a share, which put a sticker price of $4.5 million on Boyce's services. It wasn't the first time Boyce had worked out an alternative fee arrangement with a client and taken stock for payment. During the dot-com boom, he had accepted shares to represent WebMD, the website that provides medical information to consumers. Boyce had a venture capitalist's approach to cases and figured he and his firm stood to earn a lot more money by getting paid in stock. But it also meant he had a vested financial interest in Theranos that made him more than just its legal advocate. It helped explain why, in early 2013, Boyce began attending all of the company's board meetings. Even though Elizabeth's name was on all of Theranos' patents, Richard Fuse was highly skeptical that a college dropout with no medical or scientific training had done much real inventing. What was more likely, he thought, was that other employees with advanced degrees had done the work she'd patented. As the two sides prepared for trial, Fuse noticed one name that appeared as a co-inventor on many of Elizabeth's patents, Ian Gibbons. With a little research, he learned a few basic facts about the man. Gibbons was a Brit who had a PhD in biochemistry from the University of Cambridge, and he was credited as an inventor on some 50 U.S. patents, including 19 stemming from his work at a company called BioTrack Laboratories in the 1980s and 1990s. Fuse presumed that Gibbons was a legitimate scientist and that, like most scientists, he was an honest person. If he could get him to admit under oath that there was nothing in his patent that borrowed from or was similar to Elizabeth's early patent applications, it would deal a big blow to Theranos' case. He and Joe had also noticed that some of Gibbons's BioTrack patents were similar to the Theranos ones, opening the company up to charges that it had improperly recycled some of his past work. They added Gibbons's name to the list of witnesses they wanted to depose. But then something strange happened. Over the next 5 weeks, the Boyce Schiller attorneys kept ignoring their request to schedule Gibbons's deposition. Suspicious, the Fuses asked their lawyers to press the matter. Chapter 12. Ian Gibbons. Ian Gibbons was the first experienced scientist Elizabeth had hired after launching Theranos. He came recommended by her Stanford mentor, Channing Robertson. Ian and Robertson had met at BioTrack in the 1980s, where they had invented and patented a new mechanism to dilute and mix liquid samples. From 2005 to 2010, Ian led Theranos' chemistry work alongside Gary Frenzel. Ian, who had joined the startup first, was initially senior to Gary. But Elizabeth soon inverted their roles because Gary had better people skills, which made him a smoother manager. The two of them cut quite a contrast. Ian, the reserved Englishman with a wry sense of humor, and Gary, the garrulous former rodeo rider who spoke with a Texas twang. But they had a good relationship grounded in their respect for each other as scientists, and would sometimes roast each other in meetings. Ian fit the stereotype of the nerdy scientist to a T. He wore a beard and glasses and hiked his pants high above his waist. He could spend hours on end analyzing data and took copious notes documenting everything he did at work. This meticulousness carried over to his leisure time. He was an avid reader and kept a list of every single book he'd read. It included Marcel Proust's 7-volume opus, Remembrance of Things Past, which he reread more than once. Ian and his wife, Rochelle, had met in the early 1970s at Berkeley. He had come over from England to do a postdoctorate fellowship in the university's Department of Molecular Biology, where Rochelle was doing her graduate research. They'd never had children, but Ian doted on their dogs, Chloe and Lucy, and on Livia, a cat he'd named after the wife of the Roman Emperor Augustus. Besides reading, Ian's other two hobbies were going to the opera. He and Rochelle regularly went to San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House, and in the summer flew to New Mexico to attend open-air performances of the Santa Fe Opera at dusk, and photography. For laughs, he liked altering photos. One of the many he doctored showed him as a gloved and bow-tied mad scientist mixing blue and purple potions. In another, he inserted himself into the foreground of a portrait of the British royal family. As a biochemist, Ian's specialty was immunoassays, which was the main reason Theranos had focused its early efforts on that class of test. He was passionate about the science of blood testing and loved to teach it. In the company's early years, he would sometimes hold little lectures to educate the rest of the staff about the fundamentals of biochemistry. He also did presentations about how to create various blood tests that were recorded and stored on the company's servers. One source of recurring tension between Ian and the Theranos engineers was his insistence that the blood tests that he and the other chemists designed perform as accurately inside the Theranos devices as they did on the lab bench. The data he collected suggested that was rarely the case, which caused him considerable frustration. He and Tony Nugent butted heads over this issue during the development of the Edison. As admirable as Ian's exacting standards were, Tony felt that all he did was complain and that he never offered any solutions. Ian also had issues with Elizabeth's management, especially the way she siloed the groups off from one another and discouraged them from communicating. The reason she and Sonny invoked for this way of operating was that Theranos was in stealth mode, but it made no sense to Ian. At the other diagnostics companies where he had worked, there had always been cross-functional teams with representatives from the chemistry, engineering, manufacturing, quality control, and regulatory departments working toward a common objective. That was how you got everyone on the same page, solved problems, and met deadlines. Elizabeth's loose relationship with the truth was another point of contention. Ian had heard her tell outright lies more than once, and after 5 years of working with her, he no longer trusted anything she said, especially when she made representations to employees or outsiders about the readiness of the company's technology. Ian's frustrations bubbled over in the fall of 2010 as Theranos' courtship of Walgreens intensified. He complained to his old friend Channing Robertson. Ian thought Robertson would keep their conversation private, but he reported everything Ian had said to Elizabeth. Rochelle was in bed when Ian arrived at their Portola Valley home late that Friday night. He told his wife that Robertson had betrayed his confidence and that Elizabeth had fired him. To their surprise, Sonny called the next day. Unbeknownst to Ian, in the intervening hours, several of his colleagues had lobbied Elizabeth to reconsider. Sonny offered Ian his job back, albeit without the same responsibilities. Ian had been head of the general chemistry group, which was in charge of creating new blood tests beyond the immunoassays they developed for the Edison when Elizabeth fired him. He was allowed to come back as a technical consultant to the group, but its leadership was given to Paul Patel, a biochemist who had been hired 2 months earlier on Ian's recommendation. Ian was a proud man, and he took the demotion hard. The humiliation he felt was compounded when, 18 months later, the company moved to the old Facebook building and he lost the private office he'd had at the Hillview Avenue headquarters. To be sure, he wasn't the only one being marginalized by then. Gary Frenzel and Tony Nugent, too, were being sidelined, as Elizabeth and Sonny hired and promoted newer recruits over them. It was as if the company's old guard, the people who had gotten Elizabeth to this point, was being mothballed. A few months before the move, Tony had noticed a poster for the movie Women in Love in Ian's office, and they got to talking. The 1969 film was based on D.H. Lawrence's novel of the same name about the relationships between two sisters and two men in an English mining town around the time of the First World War. Ian mentioned that he'd toured Ireland when it came out, which would have coincided with when Tony was still a child growing up there. That led to other musings. Tony learned that Ian's father had been captured in North Africa during World War II. After initially being detained in a POW camp in Italy, he had been marched across Europe to a different camp in Poland, where he was liberated at the end of the war. The conversation eventually drifted back to the here and now and to Theranos. Tony, who like Ian no longer had Elizabeth's favor and was being excluded from the development of the mini-lab, floated the notion that perhaps the company was just a vehicle for Elizabeth and Sonny's romance, and that none of the work they did really mattered. Ian nodded. "It's a folie à deux," he said. Tony didn't know any French, so he left to go look up the expression in the dictionary. The definition he found struck him as apt. The presence of the same or similar delusional ideas in two persons closely associated with one another. After the move to the old Facebook building, Ian grew more sullen. He was relegated to a desk in the general population of employees with his back facing a wall. It was a symbol of how unimportant he'd become. One day, the engineer Tom Brumette ran into him at Fish Market, a seafood restaurant on El Camino Real, where he was meeting a friend. As they stood in line waiting for a table, Ian asked if he could join them. Tom and Ian were both in their mid-60s, and had established a friendly rapport. The first time they'd interacted was shortly after Tom came to work at Theranos in 2010. Upset that Sonny and other managers were disregarding his opinion during a discussion about what sort of engineering personnel should be hired to assist him, Tom had walked out of the meeting in a huff, with thoughts of quitting. Ian had come running after him and assured him that his opinion did matter, a gesture Tom had greatly appreciated. Over the next 2 years, Tom had noticed Ian's growing gloom. As they sat down for lunch at Fish Market, Tom wondered whether Ian had followed him there. Most Theranos employees ate the food Elizabeth and Sonny had catered and didn't leave the office during the day. What's more, the restaurant wasn't near the office, and Ian had walked in just a minute or two after him. Ian had probably hoped to catch him alone, Tom thought. He seemed desperate for someone to talk to. But Tom was there to reconnect with his friend, a salesman for a Japanese chipmaker. They tried to include Ian in the conversation, but he remained quiet after an initial exchange of pleasantries. Later, when he replayed the scene in his mind, Tom realized he'd ignored his colleague's silent cry for help. Tom ran into Ian one last time in early 2013 in the office cafeteria. By then, he looked despondent. Tom tried to buck him up, reminding him that he was earning decent money and urging him not to take his work predicament so seriously. It was just a job, after all. But Ian just stared at his plate, disconsolate. Ian's demotion wasn't the only thing eating away at him. Although he was now a mere in-house consultant, he continued to work closely with the person who had taken his job, Paul Patel. Paul had tremendous respect for Ian as a scientist. When he was in graduate school in England, he had read all about the pioneering work on immunoassays Ian had done in the 1980s at a company called Saiva. After he was promoted, Paul continued to treat Ian as an equal and to consult with him about everything. But they differed in one crucial respect. Paul shied away from conflict and was more willing to compromise with the engineers building the mini-lab than Ian was. Ian refused to give an inch and became furious when he felt he was being asked to lower his standards. Paul spent numerous evenings on the phone with him, trying to calm him down. During these discussions, Ian told Paul to stand by his convictions and never to lose sight of his concern for the patient. "Paul, it has to be done right," Ian would say. Sonny had put a man named Samartha Onakal, who had a PhD in chemical engineering but no industry experience, in charge of integrating the various parts of the mini-lab. Sam was perceived by some of his colleagues as a yes-man who did Sonny's bidding. Throughout 2012, Ian and Paul had several tense meetings with Sam. Ian stormed out of one of them after Sam informed them that the mini-lab's spectrophotometer didn't yet meet certain specifications Ian considered non-negotiable. Sam had previously agreed to them, but now said he needed more time. When he returned to his desk, Ian was distraught. On weekends, Ian and Rochelle often went on walks in the rolling hills surrounding Portola Valley with Chloe and Lucy, their two American Eskimo dogs. During one of these walks, Ian told Rochelle that nothing at Theranos was working, but he didn't go into any details. The strict non-disclosure agreements he was bound by prevented him from discussing anything specific about the company, even with his wife. He also bemoaned the turn his career had taken. He felt like an old piece of furniture that had been warehoused. Elizabeth and Sonny had long stopped listening to him. In the early months of 2013, Ian stopped going into the office on most days and instead worked from home. He'd been diagnosed with colon cancer 6 years earlier and had missed some time at work after undergoing surgery and chemotherapy. Colleagues assumed that the cancer had returned, but that was not the case. He remained in remission, and his physical health was fine. The problem lay with his mental health. He was in the throes of a deep, undiagnosed clinical depression. In April, Theranos informed Ian that he had been subpoenaed to testify in the Fuse case. The prospect of being deposed made him nervous. He and Rochelle discussed the lawsuit several times. Rochelle had once done work as a patent attorney, so Ian asked her to review Theranos's patent portfolio in the hope that she could give him some advice. While doing so, she noticed that Elizabeth's name was on all the company's patents, often in first place in the list of inventors. When Ian told her that Elizabeth's scientific contribution had been negligible, Rochelle warned him that the patents could be invalidated if this was ever exposed. That only served to make him more agitated. Ian couldn't tell whether there was any foundation for Elizabeth's theft allegation when he read the Fuse patent and the early Theranos patent applications side by side. But he knew one thing for sure. He didn't want to be involved in the case. And yet he worried that his job depended on it. He'd started drinking heavily in the evenings. He told Rochelle that he didn't think he could ever resume a normal schedule at Theranos. The thought of going back to the office made him sick, he said. Rochelle told him he should quit if the job made him that miserable. But resigning didn't seem like an option to him. At age 67, he didn't think he would be able to find another job. He also clung to the idea that he could still help the company fix its problems. On May 15th, Ian contacted Elizabeth's assistant to schedule a meeting with her, hoping to work out some sort of alternative employment arrangement. But when the assistant called back to confirm a meeting for the next day, Ian became anxious. He told Rochelle he was worried that Elizabeth would use the meeting to fire him. That same day, he got a call from the Theranos lawyer, David Doyle. After trying for weeks to get the Boies-Schiller attorneys to propose a date for Ian's deposition, the Fuses' lawyers had run out of patience and sent notice that he would have to appear at their offices in Campbell, California, at 9 a.m. on May 17th. That's what Doyle was calling about. With the deadline for his appearance less than 2 days away, the lawyer encouraged Ian to invoke health issues to get out of the deposition and emailed him a doctor's note for his physician to adapt and sign. Ian forwarded the email to his personal Gmail address, and from there to his wife's email address, asking her to print it. His anxiety seemed to reach a new fevered pitch. Rochelle had known for a while that Ian wasn't well, but she'd had other concerns weighing on her mind. She was grieving her mother, who had just passed away, and left behind a complicated estate to sort out, and she had just launched a new law practice with an associate. Part of her had been resentful that she wasn't getting the marital support she needed during this stressful period of her life. But Ian's anguished state that day made her realize how dire his mental condition had become. She got him to agree to get help and scheduled an appointment with his general practitioner for the next morning. When Rochelle got up around 7:30 a.m. on May 16th, she saw that the bathroom light was on and the door closed. She assumed Ian was getting ready to go to the doctor's. But when he failed to come out after a while and didn't answer her calls, she pushed the bathroom door open. She found her husband hunched over in a chair, unconscious and barely breathing. Panicked, she called 911. Ian spent the next 8 days hooked up to a ventilator at Stanford Hospital. He had taken enough acetaminophen, the active ingredient in painkillers like Tylenol, to kill a horse. Combined with the wine he'd consumed, the drug had destroyed his liver. He was pronounced dead on May 23rd. As an expert chemist, Ian knew exactly what he was doing. Rochelle later found a signed will that he'd had witnessed by Paul Patel and another colleague a few weeks before. Rochelle was overwhelmed with grief, but she found the strength to call Elizabeth's office and left a message with her assistant informing her about Ian's passing. Elizabeth didn't call back. Instead, later that day, Rochelle received an email from a Theranos lawyer requesting that she immediately return Ian's company laptop and cell phone and any other confidential information he might have retained. Inside Theranos, Ian's death was handled with the same cold, businesslike approach. Most employees weren't even informed of it. Elizabeth notified only a small group of company veterans in a brief email that made a vague mention of holding a memorial service for him. She never followed up, and no service was held. Longtime colleagues of Ian's, like Anjali Lagari, a chemist who had worked closely with him for 8 years at Theranos, and for 2 years before that at another biotech company, were left guessing about what had happened. Most thought he had died of cancer. Tony Nugent became upset that nothing was done to honor his late colleague's memory. He and Ian hadn't been close. In fact, they had fought like cats and dogs at times during the Edison's development. But he was bothered by the lack of empathy being shown towards someone who had contributed nearly a decade of his life to the company. It was as if working at Theranos was gradually stripping them all of their humanity. Determined to show he was still a human being with compassion for his fellow man, Tony downloaded a list of Ian's patents from the patent office's online database and cut and pasted them into an email. He embedded a photo of Ian above the list and sent the email around to the 24 colleagues he could think of who had worked with him, making a point to copy Elizabeth. It wasn't much, but it would at least give people something to remember him by, Tony thought. Chapter 13. Chiat Day.
"You're the leader,"
Click, click, click. Strong, powerful. Click, click. Think of your mission. Click, 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 click. The famous portrait photographer Martin Scholler was softly whispering directions to Elizabeth in his thick German accent to elicit a range of emotions from her as he snapped her picture. She was wearing a thin black turtleneck and red lipstick, her hair brushed back in a loose bun that covered her ears. Two vertical lamps were set on either side of the chair she was sitting in to flatly illuminate her narrow face and create the white lights in her pupils that were a trademark of Scholler's photographs. Hiring Scholler had been the idea of Patrick O'Neill, the creative director of advertising agency TBWA Chiat Day's Los Angeles office. Chiat Day was working on a secret marketing campaign for Theranos. The assignment ranged from creating a brand identity to building a new website and a smartphone app for the company ahead of the commercial launch of its blood testing services in Walgreens and Safeway stores. Elizabeth had chosen Chiat Day because it was the agency that represented Apple for many years, creating its iconic 1984 Macintosh ad and later its Think Different campaign in the late 1990s. She'd even tried to convince Lee Clow, the creative genius behind those ads, to come out of retirement to work for her. Clow had politely referred her back to the agency, where she had immediately connected with Patrick. A strikingly handsome man with blonde hair, blue eyes, and the sculpted physique of someone who worked out religiously, Patrick was taken with Elizabeth from the moment he met her. His attraction wasn't of a romantic nature. He was gay. Rather, he was drawn in by her charisma and her singular drive to put a dent in the universe. He'd worked at Chiat Day for 15 years, creating ads for big corporate clients like Visa and IKEA. The work was interesting, but it didn't inspire him the way Elizabeth had when she'd first come to the agency's converted warehouse in Playa del Rey and described the Theranos mission of giving people access to pain-free, low-cost health care. In advertising, it wasn't often you got to work on something that really has the potential to make the world better. Patrick hadn't been surprised or put off by Theranos' insistence on absolute secrecy. Apple had been the same way. He understood technology companies' need to protect their valuable intellectual property. In any case, the company would soon be coming out of stealth mode, as Elizabeth called it, and that's where he came in. His job was to make its commercial launch as impactful as possible. Redesigning the Theranos website was a big part of that. Scholler's photos were going to be featured on it, not just those of Elizabeth. The photographer had spent most of the two-day shoot at a studio in Culver City taking pictures of models posing as patients. They were of different ages, genders, and ethnicities, children under 5, children between 5 and 10, young men and women, middle-aged folks, and seniors. Some were white, some black, others Hispanic or Asian. The message was that Theranos' blood testing technology would help everyone. Elizabeth and Patrick spent hours choosing which patient photos to use from the shoot. Elizabeth wanted the faces displayed on the website to communicate empathy. She talked movingly about the sadness people felt when they found out that a loved one was sick and that it was too late to do anything about it. Theranos' painless blood tests would change that by catching diseases early, before they became a death sentence, she said. Patrick and a group of his Chiat Day colleagues had been flying up to Palo Alto once a week to brainstorm with Elizabeth, Sonny, and her brother Christian throughout the fall of 2012 and into the winter and spring of 2013, the period when Ian Gibbons was spiraling into depression and Steve Bird was serving out his last months as Safeway CEO. Elizabeth scheduled the meetings on Wednesdays, after learning that Apple's creative meetings with the agency had always been that day of the week. She told Patrick she admired the simplicity of Apple's brand message and wanted to emulate it. Inside Chiat Day, the Theranos assignment was known as Project Stanford. Joining Patrick on the weekly trips up to Palo Alto were Carissa Bianchi, the president of the agency's L.A. office, Lorraine Ketch, the agency's chief of strategy, Stan Fiorito, who oversaw the account, and Mike Yagi, a copywriter. Early on, the Chiat Day team decided that the best visual representation of Theranos' innovation was the miniature vial it had created to collect blood from fingertips. Elizabeth called it the Nanotainer. It was fitting because it really was tiny. At 1.29 centimeters, it was shorter than a dime positioned upright. Patrick wanted to take pictures of it to convey its scale to doctors and patients. But Elizabeth and Sonny were very concerned that word of it might leak out before the launch if anyone from the outside was allowed to see it. So they agreed that Chiat Day would use its in-house photographer to take photos of it in the little photography studio the agency had in its Playa del Rey warehouse. On the appointed day, Dan Edlin, one of Christian's Duke friends, flew down to L.A. with a custom-made plastic case containing 12 nanotainers. Checking it in with his bag at the airport was out of the question. It remained in his possession the whole flight down. When he got to the warehouse, Dan didn't let the little tubes out of his sight. No one at the agency was allowed to touch them except Patrick, who held one briefly and marveled at how small it was. Real blood tended to turn purple after a while when it was exposed to air. So they filled one of the nanotainers with fake Halloween blood and took pictures of it against a white background. Patrick then made a photo montage showing it balancing on the tip of a finger. As he'd anticipated, it made for an arresting visual. Mike Yagi tried out different slogans to go with it, eventually settling on two that Elizabeth really liked. One tiny drop changes everything, and the lab test reinvented. They blew the photo up and turned it into a mock full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal. In advertising lingo, this was known as a tip-in. Elizabeth loved it and ordered a dozen more versions of it. She didn't say what she wanted them for, but Stan Fiorito got the sense she was using them as props during meetings with her board. Patrick also worked with Elizabeth on a new company logo. Elizabeth believed in the flower of life, a geometric pattern of intersecting circles within a larger circle that pagans once considered the visual expression of the life that runs through all sentient beings. It was later adopted by the 1970s New Age movement as sacred geometry that provided enlightenment to those who spent time studying it. The circle thus became the guiding motif of the Theranos brand. The inside of the O in Theranos was painted green to make it stand out, and the photos of the patient faces and of the nanotainer balancing on a fingertip were framed by circles. Patrick also created a new font for the website and marketing materials derived from Helvetica, in which the dots over the I and the J and the periods at the end of sentences were round instead of square. Elizabeth seemed pleased with the results. While Patrick remained entranced with Elizabeth, Stan Fiorito was more circumspect. A gregarious ad industry veteran with reddish blonde hair and freckles, Stan thought there was something odd about Sonny. He used a lot of software engineering jargon in their weekly meetings that had no applicability whatsoever to their marketing discussions. And when Stan tried to get him to walk him through how he'd arrived at what seemed like extremely aggressive sales targets, Sonny gave vague and boastful answers. Normally, companies did research to determine the size of the audience they were marketing to, and then worked out what percentage of that audience they could realistically hope to convert into customers. But such basic concepts seemed lost on Sonny. Stan tried to look him up on the internet, but couldn't find anything. He thought it was strange that someone with his background, a tech entrepreneur who had sold a company during the dot-com boom and made a lot of money in the process, had left no trace on the web. He wondered if Sunny had hired someone to scrub it for him. It was also highly unusual for an obscure startup to hire a big ad agency like Chiat Day. With their overhead and staffing, the big agencies were expensive. Chiat Day was charging Theranos an annual retainer of $6 million a year. Where was this company nobody had heard of before getting the money to pay these types of fees? Elizabeth had stated on several occasions that the Army was using her technology on the battlefield in Afghanistan and that it was saving soldiers' lives. Stan wondered if Theranos was funded by the Pentagon. That would help explain the level of secrecy. Per Sunny's instructions, any materials Theranos provided to Chiat Day had to be numbered, logged, and kept in a locked room that only the team assigned to work on the account had access to. Any printing had to be done on a dedicated printer inside the room. Discarded materials couldn't just be thrown away, they had to be shredded. Computer files had to be stored on a separate server and could only be shared among the team via a dedicated intranet. And under no circumstances were they to share information about Theranos with anyone from Chiat Day's L.A. office or the agency's broader network who hadn't signed a confidentiality agreement. In addition to Mike Yagi, Stan supervised two other Chiat Day employees who worked on the Theranos account full-time, Kate Wolf and Mike Pedito. Kate was in charge of building the website, while Mike was responsible for creating in-store brochures, signs, and an interactive iPad sales tool Theranos planned to use to pitch doctors. As the months passed, Kate and Mike also began to develop concerns about their strange and demanding client. Both were from the East Coast and brought no-nonsense attitudes to their jobs. Kate, who was 28, grew up in Lincoln, Massachusetts, and played ice hockey at Boston University. Her proper, small-town upbringing had given her a strong moral compass. She also knew a thing or two about medicine. Her dad and her wife were both doctors. Mike, who was 32, was an Italian-American from Philadelphia with a cynical streak, who ran track and cross-country in college and graduate school. People didn't bullshit or take kindly to it where he came from. Elizabeth wanted the website and all the various marketing materials to feature bold affirmative statements. One was that Theranos could run over 800 tests on a drop of blood. Another was that its technology was more accurate than traditional lab testing. She also wanted to say that Theranos test results were ready in less than 30 minutes, and that its tests were approved by FDA and endorsed by key medical centers, such as the Mayo Clinic and the University of California San Francisco's Medical School, using the FDA, Mayo Clinic, and UCSF logos. When she inquired about the basis for the claim about Theranos' superior accuracy, Kate learned that it was extrapolated from a study that had concluded that 93% of lab mistakes were due to human error. Theranos argued that, since its testing process was fully automated inside its device, that was grounds enough to say that it was more accurate than other labs. Kate thought that was a big leap in logic and said so. After all, there were laws against misleading advertising. Mike felt the same way. In an email to Kate listing items that needed legal review, he included, "Automation makes us more accurate," and wrote in parentheses next to it, "This sounds like a puffery claim." Mike had never worked on a marketing campaign that involved medicine before and wanted to proceed extra carefully. Usually, healthcare campaigns, such as those involving pharmaceutical companies, were handled out of New York by a special division of the agency called TBWA Health. He wondered why it wasn't handling this assignment, or at least being consulted. Elizabeth had mentioned a report several hundred pages long supporting Theranos' scientific claims. Kate and Mike repeatedly asked to see it, but Theranos wouldn't produce it. Instead, the company sent them a password-protected file containing what it said were excerpts from the report. It stated that the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine had conducted due diligence on the Theranos technology and found it novel and sound, and capable of accurately running a wide range of routine